Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect that the time now is 1:35 p.m. on Friday, February 3, 2017. Present today we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, and myself, Co-Chair Foster, and we also have Representative Guttenberg. And Representatives Kawasaki and Thompson have been previously excused from today's meeting, and we also have Representative Pruitt. Before we start, just a reminder, please mute your cell phones. And another reminder for presenters to please avoid using acronyms, or at least spell them out first and then use them thereafter. While they may be commonly understood, public may not be familiar with them. On today's schedule, we are going to have a presentation on HB 61, modeling the Governor's Permanent Fund Protection Act, which will follow an introduction of HB 95, the FY 17 Supplemental Budget Bill. And here to present on House Bill 61 are Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue, as well as Emma Poken, Special Assistant, Department of Law. And to answer questions, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, Department of Revenue. And on the phone, we've got David Herbert, Economist, 2 Tax Division, Department of Revenue, be helping us with modeling questions. So with that, Commissioner Hoffbeck and Ms. Poken, please place yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Foster. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
For the record, Emma Poken from the Department of Law.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yesterday we covered a lot of ground on the Permanent Fund Protection Act. There was some significant concern about the 5.25% draw, whether that was sustainable and durable. And so today I'd like to walk through some of the modeling that's been done in determining the durability of that 5.25% draw and some of the impacts of some of the decisions that we make on other fiscal issues surrounding the Permanent Fund Protection Act and how that impacts the durability of a restructured permanent fund, or leaving things the way they are. So we're going to actually look at 3 different modeling scenarios today. One is the status quo, that we just that we don't make any changes, that world life just kind of goes on as it is right now, that we continue to spend on the CBR, and then when the CBR is gone, we start to spend the permanent fund earnings just the same fashion as we had the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, so that that it's just an ad hoc spending of the permanent fund earnings. Second scenario will be looking at the Permanent Fund Protection Act, the governor's bill, HB 61. If it had started in FY 17, or as it's proposed in the budget this year, where it actually has an FY 17 effective date, essentially creating a draw for FY 17 and replacing the CBR draw by having using permanent fund earnings to fund this year's budget. So immediate effective date. And there'll be we'll look at that in 2 different ways. One is with a full fiscal solution, so that the rest of the budget gap is closed, and one where the rest of the budget gap is left there, and we only just have a permanent fund-only solution. And we'll do then the same thing with not having the draw in 17, have a July 1 FY 18 effective date for the bill, and the draws would start for the fiscal year 18 budget. So that, those are the 3 scenarios that we're going to walk through today.
Mr. Chairman?
Question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you. We haven't been doing as usual. We've heard that so much as the legislature isn't doing anything. I mean, we have made a lot of reductions. We put 2 big bills forward last year that's going to save money to the state. I think everybody here is very aware. But we keep telling the public that it appears that the legislature is just going to continue to do what is usual. I just don't think that's being very respectful, and I think we've done a lot in the last few years to try to get to a sustainable level as we keep working to it. So sometimes you just keep using those same phrases when in reality there has been a lot of changes, maybe not enough yet, but I think the legislature as a whole has worked hard to start decreasing the cost of things, trying to get to a point of sustainability. We could just use, you know, what's really happening.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Sure.
We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Commissioner Hoffbeck. With what the legislature has done, we've burned through close to $6.5 or $7 billion of savings the last 2 years. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct.
Thank you. And if it's in, I'm sure it's in your packet. I've only looked through a few pages. But you're going to have what's going to be left in the CBR if this legislature does nothing on revenue again this year. You'll have a number of what will be left in the CBR if the legislature again goes to keep exhausting its CBR savings.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we aren't number intensive in this presentation. It's more graphical. You can look at the graphs and see approximately what the numbers are, but there aren't number charts in this presentation.
Through the chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, just if this legislature were to fail to adopt revenue measures this year and go straight at the constitutional budget reserve to pay the budget gap, under the governor's proposed budget, what would be left after fiscal year 18, your estimate, in the constitutional budget reserve?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, I believe it's about $2.1 billion is the most recent number.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
So the critical test that we had when we looked at the modeling and kind of gave the assignment to our staff was we wanted to maximize the use of this asset. We wanted to be able to extract as much revenue from the permanent fund without drawing down so much that we risk the corpus of the fund. So it was how much can we draw without damaging the corpus of the fund, that its real buying power would remain intact. But we also want to make sure we drew as much as we possibly could because leaving money on the table has the effect of limiting the future options we have for solving the fiscal solution. So it really was the idea was to find the sweet spot. What is the most that we can take out and still have a reasonably durable fund going forward? Going to slide 3, some of the key aspects of the modeling is that it's probabilistic. It really looks at a range of potential scenarios that could occur over time rather than deterministic, which is just to essentially choose a single scenario and just extrapolate it out over time. This uses thousands of iterations of multiple scenarios and then comes up with a range of potential outcomes and then uses, what we've done is essentially look at what is the median within that range as our most probable cause or most probable result. It's a very robust modeling process and it really focused on how the money flowed between the permanent fund, the general fund and the dividends, and really looked for failure in any of these as an issue with the modeling. So was there enough money to fund government services? Was there enough money to fund the dividend? Did we in any way, shape, or form start to impact the corpus of the fund? Was there ever a failure where there was not enough money in the earnings reserve to be able to make an annual payment? So those were the kind of the tests that we had as we were going through the system. We used as many objective resources as we could in calibrating the model to take away any concern that the model was somehow skewed to come to a specific result. And we'll talk about some of the data sources that were used in the model. But to the extent if there was an objective source available for calibrating the model, we used the objective source for calibration, and then we used Monte Carlo simulations. These multiple simulations to come up with a range of results. That was when that process started last year. And if you recall last year, there was multiple hearings where we talked about the modeling process and the various scenarios, and we were asked to bring back a tremendous number of variations on that modeling. But in order to be sure that the model was, in fact, robust and was actually measuring what we had intended it to measure, we brought in McKinsey & Company, who was kind of the gold standard of this type of work. They're an international consulting firm that work with essentially all of the sovereign wealth countries, sovereign wealth funds around the world, and have the tremendous amount of modeling capacity. And we actually asked them to come in and review our modeling process for reasonableness for accuracy, and they found that there were no mechanical errors in our modeling and that the assumptions were reasonable. They actually approved the Monte Carlo process that we used within the modeling, and they did suggest some improvements, which the DR has incorporated into the modeling going forward. Slide 4 is just a graphical representation of budgetary assumptions. The yellow line at the bottom is the fall forecasted revenues from the 2006 revenue sources book, less unrestricted royalties and production tax. And the reason that those were taken out of that is because those two are actually estimated within the modeling. So that we took them out of the baseline numbers because those become a critical component in the modeling. And then the blue line is the OMB 10-year budget plan, which you can see holds the budget flat for several years, but then allows the budget to start increasing with inflation going out into time. Slide 5. Let's talk our first scenario here, our status quo scenario. And this is, by status quo, I don't mean that the legislature hasn't done anything. What I'm saying is that if starting from today, with today's budget and today's revenues that we have, if those don't change and we just continue to spend CDR to fill the gap, what does that do to the permanent fund earnings over time? And this is just the list of assumptions that went into the process. $54.9 billion estimated starting point for the permanent fund, and that's based on end of year 2017 balance from the permanent fund corporation. So that was the objective number that we had. Right now, the permanent fund has more in it than that, but that was the objective number that we used at the time of modeling. We used the 6.95% geometric return, which again comes from the Permanent Fund Corporation, with a 12.32% standard deviation. That essentially means that it's 6.95%, but it could be as high as 19.3% and as low as a negative 5.5% on the returns. And we used an inflation rate of 2.25%, and that most of the investment returns are actually realized within the statutory net income payout, about 90%. Petroleum revenues, we look at...
Question from Representative Gere.
Just on the last page, on page 5, Commissioner, I've heard it a million times, there's an estimate of 6.95% return on the permanent fund, and I missed it. Why is the 50% probable 6.24%?
Through the chair, Representative Gere, that second line there is the realized returns, the statutory net income. So of the 6.95% total fund returns, 6.24% of that is going to be realized. So it's at 90% realization.
Thank you.
Slide 6 talks about oil price production being probabilistic modeling, similar, that's what we did with the revenue sources book as well. Deposits to the fund is 31% of the royalty will go into the fund. That is the weighted average deposit that occurs right now. Again, this is status quo. No planned payout from the general fund from the earnings reserve, but unplanned payouts would occur after the constitutional budget reserve was depleted. And we start with a CBR of $4.4 billion, which is the beginning of year 2018 balance. And we're projecting a 2.25% rate of return for the CBR.
Mr. Chair.
A question from Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, on that last slide there at the bottom. If I recall, I was under the impression that it was supposed to end at somewhere around like 3.2. And this is obviously a positive thing. It's 4.4, but tell me, you know, what happened? What was the change? What was the shift? Why do we have some substantially more than the discussion last year?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think the number was 3.2. That was kind of what we were originally talking about. Multiple things that occurred. One is cash versus accrual. The 4.4 number is the cash that will be in the fund. There are some items such as capital projects that have been approved but not funded that would show as a decrement on an accrual basis to the fund. And so the 3.2 was more of an accrual number than a cash number. But a lot of it's being driven by FY16. We had $100 million less in draws than we'd anticipated. And both fiscal year 16 and 17, we've had more revenues than were anticipated. So it's a combination of some accounting issues plus the better than projected returns when that number was first published last year.
Can I follow up on that?
Follow up.
So if we were to go, you know, trying to make sure that we're apples to apples, the same accrual basis, would it still be 4.4? Would it be? I would suspect it wouldn't be all the way back down to 3.2, but would it be a little bit lower than that?
Through the chair, Representative, I don't know that number, but I can certainly get it for you.
No problem. And then one more follow up there. Because we've hit on the CBR, SBR. I know there's something there. What are we looking at over there?
Through the chair, Representative, it's about $200 million in the SBR, and that also is this number, the 4.4 CBR SBR combination.
Oh, okay. All right. So. Thank you. Thanks for the clarification. Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
So on slide 7, then the. And again, going through, just kind of outlining what status quo is right now. The dividend calculation currently is the last 21% of the last 5 years' earnings, essentially the average of the last 5 years, just slightly more. And then the inflation proofing was a direct appropriation inflation proofing based on inflation, measured inflation from the prior year. So that's status quo. One other thing that's kind of an interesting little side note when you look at the dividend calculation, something that not everybody is aware of, but within that dividend calculation, it's the 21% of the last 5 years, or half of the remaining earnings reserve, whichever is less. So when you start to deplete your earnings reserve, you can actually get to a point where you start to decrease your dividend as well, because the dividend can never be more than half of the earnings reserve balance.
Mr. Chairman,
we've got two questions from Representative Gehr, then Representative Wilson.
Quickly, if you're talking about status quo, it's not really status quo because last year the legislature did not fund inflation proofing. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gehr, that's correct. We're just going with the statutory status quo.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was part of my question. And the other, we've heard about this 50-50 plan. If we had paid out the full dividend, which would have been, I think, about $1.2 billion, would it have left the other $1.2 billion that just stayed in the earnings reserve just from the 1 year realized earnings? Is that the right figure?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, could you run through those numbers one more time?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought that it was about $1.2 billion that would have been paid out if a full dividend had gone out. Then there would have still been approximately $1.2 billion that would have been left to put in the earnings reserve that we could have utilized with a 21 vote.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. The portion that had historically been used for inflation proofing could have been used last year, as could the rest, anything that was in the earnings reserve balance, the 8-point-some billion, any of that could have been appropriated with a simple majority vote last year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Slide 8, then, is a graphic representation of the dividend that would be paid per person under the status quo plan. And you can see that the 2018 value would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,400 under the status quo plan and the forecasted returns from the permanent fund. 2041 median value, which is the end of the modeling period, would be zero. There would be no dividend. And you can see that the dividend, if you look, just kind of to interpret this graph, the yellow bar is between the median and a 75% factor, and the blue is median to the 25% factor, and so the line between the yellow and blue is the median. So you can kind of read the line between the two, and then the whiskers are kind of the range that was within the forecast the total range, so that so you can see how far the total range could deviate over time. But you see that it falls off fairly precipitously after after a few years. And we'll put a little bit more meat on when that starts to fall a couple of slides from now. The also the status quo with no fiscal plan for the actual the size of the fund itself, and the 2041 median value for the permanent fund would be $67 billion, the real value being $39,563 million. If you remember back at our starting slide, we started with a real current value of the fund of $54.9 billion. So what you would see significant degradation in the value of the fund under the status quo. And the earnings reserve failure rate over 24 years is 98.34%. So almost absolute surety that your earnings reserve will run out of money during the forecast period. Slide 10. This one puts a little bit more of a, I think, visually on the earnings rate failure rate, earnings reserve failure rate. And, of course, the dividend is paid from the earnings reserve. So when the earnings reserve fails, so does the dividend. And you can see that by the time you get out to 2023-2024 range, you're looking at a 50-50 chance of having no money in the earnings reserve and no dividend. And then it grows from there. So that's kind of the status quo lesson. Status quo is sure failure. If nothing were done, if we just started today and just said we're just going to spend what we've got and with no other changes, the permanent fund will fail over time to be able to provide the necessary funds. So going to slide 11 now, we go into the Permanent Fund Protection Act with a FY17 effective date, essentially creating a transfer to the CBR. Because you would replace your CBR draw for this year with permanent fund earnings. So you start with a little bit lower starting value, $53.4 billion. And if you go to the middle of the slide, you can see the calculation, how you go down from 54.9 down to the 53.4. The investment returns are the same. Going to slide 12, petroleum revenues calculations are the same. But when we get to the deposit, remember we had a 31% of the royalties being deposited. Now we're down to 25% because in the Permanent Fund Protection Act, we only deposit the constitutional required deposit. We don't do the additional statutory deposit that's being made. The payout calculation is the payout calculation we talked about yesterday, the 5.25% of the five-year average of the first five of the last 6 years. And we have the $1.2 billion draw limit, where once we hit the $1.2 billion in oil and gas severance tax and royalties, that we start reducing the payout from the dividend dollar for dollar. So everything that we talked about last year is embedded within this calculation. Again, we assume unplanned payouts would come out of the earnings reserve after the CBR was fully depleted. Although under this particular method, this particular scenario where we have a full fiscal plan, it's anticipated that the budget gap will be closed and therefore there won't be those draws. But if they did occur, that would come out of the earnings reserve. And then the CBR starts with a little higher balance, 6.8, because we've now replaced that $2.4 billion draw from the CBR with a $2.4 billion earnings reserve draw. Dividend calculation is under the new formula, the 2020 formula that we talked about yesterday, 20% of the POMV payment, 20% of the unrestricted royalties. And inflation proofing is tied to the four times draw. Once the earnings reserve has four times the annual draw, that the monies would flow back into the corpus of the fund. So the structure is what we talked about yesterday when we do the modeling. So
We got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On that calculation, so the POMV percentage is fixed, and after it flows in, 20% of that POMV deposit goes out. So is that before the money flows back to inflation proofing if we are above there, or is that, or does that reduce the POMV draw?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the 20% of the 5.25 is always calculated against the maximum draw, the 5.25. So as you start to reduce your actual draw, you don't reduce your dividend. Your dividend is always calculated on what the maximum draw was, not the actual draw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You got a question from Representative Gere.
I'm not sure if this is the same question. I don't think it is. The next line, the 20% of unrestricted royalties, that amount that you come up to, does that come out of the POMV draw, or does that come out of royalties?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that comes directly from the royalties, that portion of the royalties that are not, by constitution, dedicated to the corpus of the fund. So the other 75%. And that's why it says 15%. There, 20%. Lost 25% of the 20%.
Through the chair, and then, so as long as we have a deficit, if you take 20% out of royalties instead of out of the earnings reserve, it's either going to come out of the CBR or it's going to come out of the earnings reserve. It's not like magically additional money until there's no deficit left. Correct.
So the chair, Representative Gary, I'm not sure I followed the question.
If, as long as the state's in a position where its revenues don't approach its expenditures, if you say, okay, I'm going to take 20% of royalties to pay part of the permanent fund, that's 20% left less for general fund spending, so it's a bigger CBR draw. And then instead of taking it out of the earnings reserve, you're taking it out of the CBR. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. Yes, if there was not enough in the general fund, they would. The way it's structured, the intent is that the money's come out of the royalties first, but the net effect is exactly what you're saying, that you'd have 20%, you'd have that much less in the general fund, and you'd have to make a larger CBR drop, whether you say it's for the dividend or just for covering the rest of the general fund expenditures is. The mathematics didn't make any difference.
Thank you.
So slide 14, what's the impact on the dividend per person under the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act? The again, this one has the guaranteed dividend, $1,000 starting dividend. By 2041, the dividend would be $1,416. And would essentially float around that $1,000 dividend through the 24-year life of the forecast. It doesn't spike up real high, it doesn't go low, it just kind of hangs around that $1,000 range. The effect on the fund itself, the 2041 value of the permanent fund would be $99,254,000,000. We started at $53.4 billion. The real value of that $99 billion is $58,188,000,000. So the fund actually is growing at a rate greater than inflation. So it's not only is protecting the fund, it's actually allowing the fund to grow slightly over time. And the earnings reserve failure rate is 1.12%. So very little chance of the earnings reserve ever being depleted to the point where it couldn't make the annual payment. Next slide is a graph of that. Doesn't really show much because it just kind of follows the same line as the baseline. Slide 17.
Question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Randy, could you just go back to that projected dividend into 2041? What are the factors in play that would prevent the dividend from increasing in value with at least inflation? Because you're saying it's going to remain around $1,000 into 2041, so in essence the value of that is going to consistently go down. So what would be what's in the formula that would prevent the dividend from trying to keep pace with inflation?
So the chair, Representative Ortiz, it's primarily the production forecast, and of course the royalty side of that equation is based on production price and production, and so We have a, we don't see large price increases, and we see falling production over time. So that piece is going to drop.
Thank you.
And we're on slide 17. Same scenario, Permanent Fund Protection Act, but this time, and with the FY17 transfer, but this time now with no fiscal plan. So this leaves that structural deficit in the budget, and not knowing how much will result, we're just assuming this, the current structural deficit would remain in the budget, and that. As we had in our prior assumptions, that once the CBR is depleted, you would turn to the earnings reserve to continue to fill the gap. So, what impact does that then have on the durability of the permanent fund and the size of the dividend? The dividend paid per person again would start out at $1,000 protected, would grow to $1,239 over the life of the fund of the projection, the 24 years of the projection, so about $200 less than it would have been if under a full fiscal plan, real value that is less than the $1,000 24 years out. The value of the fund, 2041, the median value of the fund is $76 billion. Which gives you a nominal value of $44.6 billion. We started at $53.4 billion. So under this scenario, you do see degradation of the fund itself over that period of time. And we have an earnings reserve failure rate of 45.38%. So a very good chance that at some point in time, there won't be money in the earnings reserve to make the dividend payment or the funding government expenditures.
You got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I apologize. I know you and I had a conversation that without sleep, we have both a headache, and I'm thinking more slowly than I was before, so I'm sure I missed something that you said. But before, you made clear, if I was reading it right, that without a fiscal plan, the state will run out of both savings and then we'll run out of earnings reserve money to even pay a dividend. So you're saying here, with no fiscal plan, we'll still have a dividend. You mean with just the earnings reserve portion of your with just the permanent fund portion of your plan and not the rest of a fiscal plan? Is that what that chart shows?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. It's a permanent fund only solution where all that you do is restructure the permanent fund, but make no other changes. So yeah, so this would be a permanent fund only solution.
Got another question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, as far as how much money in the budget are you talking about, and how much growth each year is this based on? So, when you're talking about you have no fiscal plan, is it based on what's the starting number right now, and do you have calculated 1%, 2%, or growth, or do you have a so many percent decrement when you did these different ones?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, back on slide 4, you can kind of see graphically the budgetary numbers. So the budget stays flat through fiscal year 2020, and then it starts to grow with inflation.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so just to make sure, so flat, you mean there's no gain in it whatsoever, so you're not putting in new contracts, or you talk about exactly the same amount until that year, and then you have inflation being put in.
It's essentially flat. I couldn't drill down and say there's what's in and out of it, but the budget number is essentially the same as it is today up through 2020, the $4.2 billion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's really important because some people see flat as $4 billion. That's what we're looking at. Others see it as we have contracts and other things in order, and that would be putting those percentages in because we have those kinds of obligations. So a clarification of how those numbers work within all three of these would be very helpful.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is no dollar growth in the budget through 2020. So if there's contract increases, we're absorbing them someplace else up through 2020. It's after 2020 you start seeing growth at the rate of inflation. So,
all
Slide 19 then is I talked about nominal fund size. Yeah, so slide 19 just shows you when you start seeing the potential for failure within the earnings reserve, and you see that it's pretty stable up through the late 2020s, and then your chance of failure grows dramatically. And going to the next slide, you can see exactly why that happens, is that you'll have under the permanent fund only solution with the FY17 transfer, you see that you've got CBR money to fill the void up till 2028, and then at that point in time you're starting to tap into the earnings reserve, and that's why you start seeing a much greater chance of failure of the earnings reserve as you move forward.
Got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where it says other revenue draws, is that only the CBR, or does that include drawing from the Higher Education Fund, PCE, and those things as well?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's only the CBR. Okay, slide 21 then is a FY18 start. So the scenario is very similar to the last two scenarios that we just did, except now we're not doing a FY17 draw. We're not starting until the FY18 year. And again, this first scenario is with a full plan that we're going to fix everything as well as implement the Permanent Fund Protection Act. So you'll see that your permanent fund starting value is higher because we don't have the 17 draw against the permanent fund. And the other significant one is on the page 22. The CBR is lower because we didn't have that payback to the CBR. Dividend calculation on 23 is exactly the same as in the past. And so we get to slide 24. And what is the impact on the dividend with a FY18 starting date and a full fiscal plan? The dividend, again, starts at 1,000, grows to 1,468. If we had done the FY17 draw, that was 1,416, so it's about $50 more at the end of the period than it would have been if we don't do the FY17 draw.
We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I guess I'm just not following. On slide 22.
Yep.
We had the CBR at 4.4, and on the earlier one, on slide 6, we had the CBR as 4.4. And I thought you said the draw didn't occur, so the CBR was higher.
Rather than slide 6, if you went back to the beginning of the non-status quo scenarios, so slide... That's a tiny number. Slide 12. You can see that on slide 12, the CBR draws $6.8 billion. All right, so it's up on the screen now.
Okay.
So that's the beginning of the FY17. Effective date slides is that, and that's where that shows up. So then slide 25 is the effect on the fund, the permanent fund itself. If with a FY18 effective date, the fund would grow to $104.079 billion over the 24-year period, a real value of $61 billion. We started at 55.8, we grew to 61. So again, under this scenario with a full fiscal plan, the fund will grow at a rate greater than inflation, and the earnings rate, estimated failure rate, is 0.18%, so less than 1/5 of 1%. So there's very, very little chance of failure under that scenario. And going to slide 27. Now we do exactly the same scenario, FY18, but with not solving any other of the fiscal issues. the permanent fund dividend drops goes from 1,468 under the full plan down to 1,271 over the life of the projections, the 2040 life of the projections. Slide 28, the nominal value of the fund drops to $46.3 billion, down from $55.8. So there is a degradation of the fund itself if you don't fix the rest of the fiscal problem, as well as just implementing the permanent fund. And with the 44.61% failure rate of the earnings reserve. Slide 29 again shows that the failure rate starts to climb in the late 20s, again, because when you go to slide 30, you see that's when the CBR runs out and you start tapping into the earnings reserve to fill the void. In conclusion, there's very little difference in durability with or without the FY17 drop. The fund is slightly more durable. The fund grows slightly larger. The dividend is slightly larger under FY18 start date, which makes sense. But that doesn't really impact the durability of the fund. The 5.25% draw works under this modeling. That it is durable. It is sustainable. In all models where it's part of a full fiscal solution. It is not durable, it is not sustainable as a standalone solution. It needs to be part of a broader plan. And with that, I will close my presentation and open it up to questions.
Thank you. So before we we'll go ahead and take questions, and then after that I'll be passing the gavel off to Representative Seaton, and we'll be going into the supplemental budget. So with that, are there any questions of the committee?
Can you make one last comment then? Sure. I know we've covered a lot of ground in the last yesterday and today, and Emma Pocan is available for anyone who would like to have a little more detail or time to walk through the various forecasts or get a better understanding. I know that it's that there's some complexity to it, and so she's available for assistance and to meet with anybody one-on-one that may want more information on the modeling. Thank you.
Well, good. Thank you, Commissioner. We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you, and this is just on one of the fiscal notes, and maybe you can come later. The permanent fund dividend, the transfer is made for prisoners,
yes.
And it was, I think, calculated on the full dividend, and so is there a necessity for a transfer from another account to fund that, or how are you accounting for that? And if you're not prepared, I just wanted to get it on the record that that was a calculation or a fund transfer or fund source we want to see.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Seaton, you're absolutely right. I'm not prepared to answer that, but we will get that answer to you.
Okay, real good. Well, we will take a moment here to pass the gavel over to Co-Chair Seaton. With that, we'll be at a brief at ease.
Welcome back to House Finance. And now we are going, we have HB 95, Governor's Supplemental Bill before us. And so here's Office of Management Budget Director Pat Pitney, and would you please introduce the bill?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney, Office of Management and Budget. Today I'll just go through the kind of the components of the supplemental budget request and highlight some of the more significant items. The information packet that's provided has a list of every change that's presented in the supplemental bill. So on the first summary sheet, see total supplemental request is $51.7 million for unrestricted general fund and $113 million in total. Over the past several years, this is one of the smaller supplemental requests that has come forward. The next page shows a breakout of the operating supplementals by department. After that, you have, and the operating supplementals for unrestricted general fund total $51.6 million and $95 million in total funds. The next page is the capital appropriations. And that is $75,000 in unrestricted general funds and $18 million in total funds. So, what's underneath those numbers? Now I'm on the detail sheet. I'm not going to go through every one, but I can answer questions on ones if I skip it and somebody's curious about what I've skipped.
And just for clarity, you're on page 1 of 10?
I'm on page 1 of 10. So there's line numbers on the page, so I'm on line 2. So that first request is an increase request that includes unrestricted general funds for the health insurance rate increase. The rate is increasing from $13,046 per month to $1,346 a month to $1,555 a month. Last year at this time, we came forward with an amendment request for the 17 budget when we recognized that our reserves were getting very low and that we would need to have a rate increase associated with 17. Rather than a rate increase, there was a deposit into the working reserve in fiscal year 16 that bolstered the reserve amount. That allowed us to get from July to January on the old rate. The Department of Administration put in several saving measures, and we also increased the cost to all employees for their health care premiums. But all of those actions were not enough to keep the reserve healthy, and so we had to do this mid-year rate increase. These are not normal, but this is the same rate that is in the 18 budget request. So that totals $6 million, of which $5.3 million is unrestricted general funds. And that was last year, the budget, the unrestricted general fund was not provided, but many of the non-general fund components were provided for a health rate increase. That's why the general fund is such a bigger part of this right now. The next item line 3, is we were negotiating the supervisor union contract, and it included furlough days. That negotiation ended after the budget was put together last year, and so this reduces the budget in accordance with those mandated furlough days.
And just for committee members, if you have any questions as we go, ask them as we go while we're on the line. Representative Gehr.
Thank you, Pat. Maybe another point is the time to do this. The court system has a budget savings by offering their own voluntary retirement incentive plan, which is if you're 3 years past retirement age, ready to retire, they offered people 3 months' pay, and a number of folks retired, and they generated some somewhat significant cost savings. Is that something that's going on in other departments, too? Or is that something you want to answer some other day?
Probably something that would be better answered another day.
Thanks.
So the other two were vendor administrator fees and Department of Defense reimbursement. More not really significant items, but I can talk about them if somebody is curious. I'm on page 2 now. Line 6, the Public Defender's Agency receives receipts from collections for when they represent a client. They receive collections from those clients, oftentimes from the permanent fund dividend garnishment, and with the dividend at a much lower rate, those receipts collections are down. This is replacing the amount that was expected from those collections that have not materialized.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
On that point, do you know the last time it was looked into what it takes to even qualify for a public defender? You know, whether that's been updated. I know there's a formula on your income, and then some can get it even though they don't have the money right away, and that's kind of how you end up with this at $455,000, but has anyone in the administration reviewed to see whether or not that's still kind of the right spot, or maybe it needs to be updated, especially since we kind of have a revolving door still when it comes to the prison system and a lot of money goes out on that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's an excellent question. The amount a defendant pays is based on a court decision. And it is a current conversation about what are the criteria that judges use to determine how much should be paid. And in one of the best parts about the criminal or the justice reform effort last year was the conversations among the different parties, and some of these issues have come out and now are being looked at more aggressively.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Item number 7 is a federal grant that will allow us to address some audit issues on our commercial driver's license examiners. This will create a $36,000 ongoing cost as well for the software that will be implemented. Let's see. Item number 8 is an increase due to a classification study that was completed in December of 2016, moving occupational license examiners from a range 13 to a range 14. And there's a corresponding amendment in, or there's a corresponding amount in the 18 budget as well that comes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
I'm just curious, do you know what that amount is by chance?
The 18, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's like 165 or 170,000.
I get the idea.
We can get the exact number. So the next two on page 3 are both technical items. Page 4 is where we have the more significant ones. So lines 11, 12, 13, and on page 5, line 14, are supplemental requests for the Medicaid program. The if you recall, last summer we delayed payments in 16 and pushed them into 17 because the 16 budget was insufficient to cover those payments. So we did essentially two check writes into 17, and the amount requested here are those two check writes. The amount of money in Medicaid is $580 million. With this 27, then it's $27 million higher. That amount is $60 million, just over $60 million less than it was in 15. In fiscal year 17 alone, not counting the expansion population, there's been a 9% increase in enrollment and a 12% increase in utilization. So all of the reform efforts, all of our ability to move billing from state funding to federal funding has still allowed the Medicaid program to stay steady and below where we were in 15. So
we have a question from Representative Guerra.
Could you say that again? So the increase in utilization, the increase in cost because of the increase in utilization, and the comparison between fiscal years, what you just addressed. I just went too fast for me to write it down.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Guerra. In 17 alone, the number of people eligible for Medicaid increased 9%. The utilization, including the utilization, it's up 12%. So driven by 9% more that are covered, and then of those that are covered, they're using more. And so utilization is up a total of 12%. And this is in the regular Medicaid program, the non-expansion program. There were reform efforts, and there were several savings initiatives going on prior to the reform efforts. And with that, we're over $60 million below where we were in fiscal year 15 on an annual basis. So that's recurring savings.
And so is that before or after this?
After this.
After this supplemental, $60 million below 2015 Medicaid.
Yeah. And
all payments.
Great.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So do you have like numbers? I mean, actual numbers. I mean, 9%, I don't know how many there are now. And so 12, and then I know the 12% is based on now, that extra 9% plus whatever you had in there. Mm-hmm. And do you have any idea? I mean, that's pretty substantial. That seems pretty substantial. You know, why we saw such an increase?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't have them on the top of my head. We can get them to you fairly quickly. It is reflective of two items. One is the economy. We are losing jobs. That's the biggest driver. The other driver is the number, as people age, that they become
seniors.
We are becoming older, and that tends to push the push more. In a higher proportion of our people are older, and that pushes more into Medicaid. Just by the nature of who's on.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So I know in the regular Medicaid program, if it's for doctors and things like that, that there's no cap. I thought I had an understanding when through the discussions last year that for the optional portions of it, that a limit could be set, that, you know, once the funds are kind of done, they're done. And I for some reason thought we did that last year. So I know you can't do it in the top part, only on the optional. Is that right, or am I maybe remembering something else?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I would have to ask Health and Social Services on that question.
I'd appreciate that, because I really did think on the optionals last year, Mr. Chairman, that those programs were capped. I know you can't do it on the medical part of it, but like the dental and the others that's, you know, in legislation have put forward, that kind of like the heating plan, that you could actually cap how high it went. So we'll find out, because that may have an impact this year as we're putting the budget together.
And Representative Wilson, are you talking about a dollar cap, or are you talking about the cap like you can only get a new set of teeth once every 2 years, or a new set of glasses, you know, the number of time limitation on the amount of service, or are you talking about a dollar cap?
Mr. Chairman, I thought it was a dollar amount. I know we have those others for how many eyeglasses and how those things did, but I thought for the program itself, there was a number that was given for the optional plans that the Health and Social Services just couldn't go over that amount.
We'll see if
need to make sure that I remember correct.
Look at that, or we can. We'll just ask Health and Social Services question.
Yeah, the response should pretty much answer. Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, through the chair. Pat, I'm just a little confused. So on pages 4 and 5, all the titles are FY16 costs that for various reasons we had to delay in paying FY17, and there are four different of those: the $2.9 million one, a $219,000 one, a $15.9 million one, and then on page 5, a $7.6 million one. All the titles are FY16 costs that we had to make in FY17 for various reasons. But then separately, you're talking about, and plus we didn't anticipate there would be more people using Medicaid in FY17 than we thought. The economy is down. But the ones I see before me are all related to sort of late payments, not related to the inaccurate prediction of how many people would need Medicaid, which obviously when they apply and they qualify, we have to pay it. And so those two categories, yeah. I only see one of those categories here, the delayed payments.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, this savings initiatives, the memorandum of agreements with providers that allows us to have a higher billing on federal, and then the management, utilization management initiatives that Health and Social Services have put in place very aggressively, we believe will offset all of those unanticipated growths. So they're managing the program, keeping the costs contained, and we believe that they can manage. Had they not had to write these checks from 16 into 17, through their management initiatives, would have been able to meet the overall budget target. But they're doing many, many things, and they're going to be very tight at the end of the year in meeting their overall costs. But they're doing, but through these savings initiatives, the reforms that were put in place, they believe that they can squeak in under the wire.
The chair, just understand.
Representative here.
Yeah, so just so I understand, in terms of the increased number of people applying for Medicaid that you did not anticipate, you're not seeking a supplemental because you generated savings, and so that the governor's original FY18 budget doesn't require you to ask for a supplemental. You've generated savings, and those will pay for the increase in the number of people who qualify for Medicaid and that we're paying for. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, there's only one correction there, our 17.
Right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Okay, great. Thanks. And then these totals are, why are these four separate components?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, each of these are different components, allocations within the appropriation.
Oh, behavioral so, health, yep. Dental. Got
yep.
it.
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
So the next, I'm on page 6. Well, the rest of 5 and the first few items on 6 are all smaller, primarily grants or accounting technical changes. I'm on page 6, line 24. The first capital supplemental request is a Whale Pass organizational grant. When a new city is formed, they're entitled to a $75,000 grant from Department of Commerce. This satisfies that statute.
Reverend Guttenberg.
Maybe this is broader than just a simple supplemental, and if that's the case, just we incorporate somebody new through this process. This is the first of a lot of new calculations for a new municipality. Have you started to figure out when we? I mean, in some cases, the state, when a community isn't organized, the state is the primary organization around it. Have you started to calculate the other issues that are going to result with having a new, I'm not sure if they're going, or they're second-class city, becoming a second-class city? Has that become a calculation that has been started, whether it's the student enrollment counts or the municipal assistance or all those other things that go into it? I mean, this is a small community, but it kind of will change the calculations down the pike.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is an excellent question and a good prompt to go and figure that out.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, community revenue sharing would be one of the items in there. Yeah. And
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So,
Representative Guerra.
Just going back to the last question, I guess I still don't understand. So last year, the department came to us, and they've been very aggressive and very successful at leveraging extra federal funds to try and replace state funds. And as I recall, they presented a number of initiatives where they were going to reduce the FY17 budget by generating extra federal funds. Now, more people have applied for Medicaid than we thought, 9% or 12% more, and they've generated extra costs. How does that get offset by federal savings that I thought were already reflected in the budget last year? I just want to know that we're not making the department all of a sudden absorb. And I don't know how much money is in how much money these extra 12% that we didn't forecast to be in the Medicaid program cost the state in terms of general funds, because you're just telling us they're going to get absorbed. But are there extra federal savings that the department has generated that we did not reflect in the FY17 budget? I thought we had reflected all those in the FY17 budget.
So, through the chair, Representative Garrett, the 9% additional eligible and 12 is the actual change year over year. There was some of that was anticipated, not 12%. The question is a complex question, and I would be happy to sit down in with Health and Social Services. We have all of those. What is going up and what is coming down? You know, among the savings initiatives, there are some that are going faster than others, or getting higher than expected savings. There's others that are going the other direction and not as good as savings. But there's things in pharmacy, and there's the travel agreements, and you know, there's several. But it would be better to have that as a standalone discussion, either in, you know, in private or in a hearing.
I'll just state my concern.
Reverend Guerra and then Ortiz.
My concern is that my concern, unfortunately, is the way the language is spoken in this building. My concern is that there are extra costs for FY17. That happens almost every year. In a recession, you have more people apply for Medicaid. You didn't anticipate it. There is some portion of that. There is some extra number of millions of dollars the state paid in Medicaid that we didn't anticipate. And by absorbing it all, but then in FY18, then just sort of readjusting the base to show this many more people are using Medicaid, my concern is there's going to be a big gap between the budget in FY17 for Medicaid and the budget in FY18 for Medicaid, because the F18 Medicaid budget will show these extra people, and somehow the 17 Medicaid budget somehow is absorbing these costs. And I guess I don't know if the comparisons between the budget years are going to be true. That's my concern.
Ms. Pitney, can I ask a question to clarify that? I think we've got a couple of things mixed up from what I'm hearing. You're saying that in 17 we've got 9% more eligible people, and we have 12% greater utilization overall. But that is offset in 17 with savings that have occurred. These costs that were from 16 and are being paid in 17 are independent of the number of new eligibles and the utilization rate. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So I hope that's what I heard, and I'm just trying to clarify. We probably should have had those two conversations separately, because the number of eligibles now and the utilization rate are not included in any figures here, but those are being absorbed in the cost savings that were generated for this year, as we're understanding. The question that I think Representative Guerra is saying is, didn't we anticipate those questions and reduce the budget by the amount of the savings, or are the savings greater than we anticipated for 17?
So thank you, Chair Seaton, for the clarification. The 17 budget was reduced from the 16 budget for savings initiatives. Many of those are going well. Some of them aren't going as well. The independent of all of those, the Medicaid group is managing the program and managing their care utilization to limit costs where they can, and we are administratively asking them to manage as tight as they possibly can, and understanding that they have to have best case to complete the 17 budget. But we believe the 17 budget is going to be adequate to meet the 17 costs. But there is a small chance that we might have to do check right into 18. And if it's apparent we will early enough, we will come back and talk to this group.
Thank you. Vergara, did you have a further question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just from what I hear, the math does not add up, and from what I've heard from the department, they are trying to achieve the federal savings that were in the budget last year, and they haven't been able to achieve all those savings. So on one hand, we have less federal money coming in than we thought. And then there's some part of this 12% of additional people who are seeking Medicaid that we anticipated last year and put in the budget, and there's some extra additional number of people who are getting Medicaid services because we didn't anticipate them. So we have less money coming in for federal replacement money than we had hoped for. I know the department's working as hard as they can. We have more Medicaid costs going out. I don't understand, without cutting something else within the department that you're not telling us about, how you can have less federal funds, more state expenditures, and not be asking for a supplemental, and then leaving it for 18 maybe.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the logic is there that you have expressed. The federal savings, as we've worked through with the department, they're not lining up program by program, but collectively they are lining up. So we will receive the state savings based on what the federal's putting or close. We're asking, and they are actively managing all of their items. We're watching this on a month-to-month basis on expenditures. We're watching every check write. And we believe that through their efforts, we can get through this fiscal year with this amount of money, with a small chance that we might come back in mid-March, early April, and say we expect a small amount having to be written into 18.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My frustration is this is going to...
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, through the chair. These are FY17 costs. My anticipation is that they are going to be real FY17 costs. You can't treat more people with Medicaid services, with annual increasing costs of medical care for free. And so you're going to have an FY18 supplemental, or FY18 amended budget maybe, that's going to add costs to the budget when they're really FY17 costs that should have been paid. And so it's going to skew the budget comparison between years and make it look like the budget is going up when they should have been paid in FY17. That's my concern.
Through the chair, I hear your concerns, and we are confident enough that the 17 budget is going to meet the 17 needs. There is a chance that all of the management efforts will fall a little bit short, and if that's the case, we'll come back and talk to you. But we feel confident enough. We wanted to keep these requests low. We want to leave the pressure to manage the program high. And we feel confident enough that we can get through this year with this amount of money.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. On the same subject, broad subject, the expansion of Medicaid brought in a new set of small group of people, higher than anticipated. Some of the projected savings were intangibles. Fewer emergency room, better handling of chronic illnesses. Is there a aspect of this that is trying to measure that? And we have a changing population and it's shifting around, and that part of the problem of trying to understand who this, the effect that this group has on the intangibles and the emergency rooms and those other things. Is the department trying to measure that against what we're doing? The expanded Medicare group, do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and sorry, Representative Ortiz, I forgot that you had your hand up.
Oh, no problem, Mr. Chairman. Pat, I'm probably more of a concrete guy than some of these other folks over here, think a little higher level. Let's go back to the $60 million. You told me, what I think I understood is, the state spent $60 million less dollars for Medicaid than they did in 2015. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes.
Gotta feel good about that. Thanks.
Are we through with this? Okay. We'll draw some pictures and bubble charts and figure out where we are and come back. Thank you.
Moving on, we're on page seven. Line 25 and 26 are both fishing game supplementals. The first supplemental is continuation of studies that were started in 2013, and there are two groups, the Pacific Seafood Processors and the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, who are funding the continuation of the studies. The second one is the necessary match and the federal funds to receive the Pittman-Robertson funds that are available for Alaska. The match source is a fish and game fund. And so then this is a capital project, so there's underneath that project there are several, there's a priority list of projects that they would use that money on.
Before you go on, the other funds, the matching funds, is that an ongoing anticipated match that takes place, or is this additional $9,000 of federal funds that became available that wasn't anticipated?
Chair Seaton, there's been periodic capital requests to receive the Pittman-Roberts funds, and this is that periodic capital request to make sure we can receive and spend the Pittman-Roberts fund that are available. So this is regular in nature, and the reason it's a supplemental is because we apparently it was regularly done in the supplemental, which I wasn't aware of, and it should have been in either the original 17 budget or in the 18 budget.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further questions on those two? Go ahead.
So page 7, line 30, this is a kind of a technical one. 2 years ago, there was capital project funding put in because there were several negotiations going on. This is just allowing them to continue to use it as they are working on labor negotiations. Then there's a reappropriation. So this is line 31, reappropriation for the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System. There was $3 million is the amount, and the project that it is coming from is there was an idea when there was money that we would have a driving range. This is a car driving range at the Sitka Police Academy. And DPS feels that having the Elmar system updated or it's maintained and to keep it working, that it was more important than a new driving range at the police academy. We are about $1.5 million short of what is necessary for the Elmar, and we're looking for a source to cover that $1.5 million in addition to this $3 million.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, just clarification on that. Is that to maintain a system or is that for upgrades? What exactly in relation to the system?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's both. There's there's the operating system component, and then there's the equipment maintenance and refresh. And so this is keeping, this is bringing that system to the supported level that it is.
Just clarifying that.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just trying to figure out what then the next year's and the next year. So is this, what should we expect in the future then if out of this amount?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, about this amount pretty consistently. And if you went with the records that they've put forward, probably in the 5 to 6 to 7 million range. It's an expensive system. It is a system that all of the public safety people use throughout the state. So it is our emergency communication system statewide.
Yeah, and I understand that portion. I'm just trying to make sure that I understand, you know, because every year are we both maintaining and we're upgrading? Is the upgrading piece of this a continual every year? There's something we have to do to upgrade it, or is that just? I mean, it seems like that might be all grouped in maintenance or updating.
Through the chair, so the. Like the software type upgrades would be not every year. The equipment maintenance would be every year, and it's just the cycle of what you're doing, which ones and what maintenance is being done. So it would be a combination.
Seeing no other questions, go ahead.
So. On page 8, line 32 is being able to receive a federal grant. Line 33 is a more significant item. Line 33 is a request for $8 million for the Department of Corrections. One of the Medicaid expansion savings was the ability to bill Medicaid for prisoners who were in a hospital for more than 24 hours. And that particular provision is working. However, the healthcare costs for inmates as a whole did not materially change by being able to bill those that are out 24 hours. So they're seeing increases for three reasons. One, they have some nursing staff turnover, so they're using overtime and temporaries. Two, they have higher drug cost requirements. And three, just the utilization is higher than anticipated. So the department had asked for $11 million to cover these costs. Through working with the department, we're trying to really maximize the, you know, what management actions can you take to contain the costs. And so what we've asked is that they look across their department for savings to contribute to this $11 million, and then requesting up to $8 million to offset this cost. So this is going to take a combination of tight management and the rest of corrections and tighter management within the healthcare area, their entire management at this point is really hiring nurses so that they have adequate coverage. So it is, again, this very asking the commissioner and his management team to scrutinize every cost and to fit in what they think is $11 million to find $3 million more in savings and only have $8 million come from the general fund.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we were able to look into this a little deeper. So it's my understanding that if an inmate is at a halfway house or on electronic monitoring, they will be able to take advantage of Medicaid expansion. Yet Department of Corrections has cut their halfway houses down by about, I think it was about $8 million. The electronic monitoring they currently have is also in half. They had over 400 about a year ago. Now they're down to 200. And if you're talking about some of the high-cost medical that you may have in there, I think those are two very good avenues that we're not utilizing within that. One excuse that we've heard is, you know, people walk away from the halfway house, which Representative Guttenberg and I have heard many of those stories. But that's a contract issue. I mean, if they're walking away, then that should be up to the contractor to make sure. But it just seems like to hope that we would see these savings by just being in there 24 hours, I mean, I imagine the hospital wants to get them in and out so they don't have to have all the paperwork instead, mm-hmm. where we have two sources that, for whatever reason, have both been cut that I think ultimately have this is kind of what we're seeing is this high cost because now if you're a prisoner in the system, they can't utilize those. So I hope you would have that discussion to see why we're putting everybody in a more high way of being able to pay for them versus these other two avenues, which for our low offenders, which is a big chunk of them, could really show some savings, not just in Medicaid expansion, but also within the prison system itself.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, thank you. We'll look into it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
So I guess I'm a little concerned about the corrections issue, which seems to me, and I'm not going to go through the Medicaid issue, but they look the same. So the Commissioner of Corrections said they have $11 million of costs that are uncovered that they did not anticipate. They requested an $11 million increment to deal with them, and in shorthand, the administration has said you're not getting $11 million. Go find $3.7 million of savings that were never identified in the budget last year. That's aggressive but fair shorthand for what's going on, right?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, yes.
Okay. All right.
Ms. Pitney, I guess I had a question. Department of Corrections identified that one of the problems was that medical facilities were not identifying times when people were out so that the 24 hours wasn't being tracked, and so there was no mechanism to build Medicaid for the 100 or the 95% federal reimbursement. Has that been taken care of?
Chair Seaton, the commissioner's office staff or the admin services officer staff actually look at the bills to confirm that it wasn't 24 hours, and so they're actively managing that aspect. And when it's somebody's stayed over 24 hours, then they send it back. So they are doing that on a case by case basis.
It seemed like when someone that's incarcerated basically leaves incarceration, we should know that within the system, and that should. But you said they're automatic. They are tracking all of those now to make sure they catch that. Okay. Any other questions? I don't see any.
Yeah. I'd add one point to that. There is a. So, there is somewhat of a disincentive for the provider. I think Representative Wilson actually mentioned that the paperwork of the Medicaid billing, it's harder for a provider to bill Medicaid and, you know, easier to bill corrections directly. If they bill corrections directly, they actually get higher reimbursement. So there's some built-in incentives / disincentives that hopefully we can manage through that those aren't those are longer-term management issues, you know, contract management issues that we work through.
Okay, thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
No, thank you, but I don't want to get wrapped around the axle, but something you just said. So if the provider builds the state or corrections, they get a higher reimbursement rate than if they had billed Medicaid. Does the state, when it goes back to Medicaid for billing for the same service, I assume they're eligible and we just do that, or maybe I'm wrong, do we get the same rate that we paid, or do we get the lower rate?
Through the chair.
Maybe I had that wrong.
Can you ask the question again?
Okay. So what you said, the way I heard it, is the provider would rather bill corrections because they get a higher reimbursement rate than if they just bill directly to Medicaid. When we do we get reimbursed for Medicaid a comparable number? Which number do we get reimbursed?
So through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the provider provider gets the Medicaid rate if they're billed on Medicaid, which is lower than if they billed corrections directly on the corrections rate. The rate is something that we can begin to adjust. It's just we have to get through the transition.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
On page 9.
I think we're back one more time on correction. Yeah. Representative Gehr.
Hopefully this isn't the answer. Can you tell us... Is a part of the $11 million shortfall for the Department of Corrections the fact that there are less withheld felon permanent fund dividend funds than anticipated, and now we have to make up for that?
And we cut the dividend in half.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, no, that was adjusted. This year's felon funds were based on last year's check amount. So we're a year, the amount in the budget is a year lagging, so it won't ever have a problem on that particular one.
Thanks.
And so on page 9, the one of significance on this page is the injection, line 37, the Class B injection wells, the consent decree. This was an agreement that Department of Transportation and came to with the EPA, and this is on the oil well, how they were collecting oil in their maintenance stations. And so this is cleaning that up. That one's off the table. Then the last item on that page, line 38, was the result of refinancing. We had a savings of $655 million from refinancing the Goose Creek debt.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, on that one, obviously, you know, nice to see a decrease, but how did that, what changed in those terms? I mean, did we extend it more years? Did we get a lower rate? Are we going to end up paying more in the long run? What's kind of the details on that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I can get you the precise details, but it was really taking advantage of the interest rate reduction.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love to see that. Thank you.
So page 10, the line 39. This is a $3 million request for the Disaster Relief Fund. So we have a Disaster Relief Fund. If there's a disaster, we're able to use the funds that are there. The fund is now sitting at about $2 million. We traditionally try to keep it at $5 million. And actually, prior to, you know, I'm sure in the years before my time, it was much higher, but we've tried to keep it about $5 million. And so this just replenishes that fund in the event there are disasters. And then each of those disasters is reported to the body.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
So we're missing the wildfires. I mean, we're always used to having wildfires. They're always in the supplemental. And yeah. I know from the Fairbanks aspect, we did have wildfires this year. Did the federal government pick all that up for us?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. I'll have to check into that. It has not come up, so I think we have plenty of funds in it.
So follow up?
Representative Wilson.
What's in that fund? I mean, we had enough to cover it. I kind of like to know where, because every year I've been here, and there's always been a supplemental. And in fact, we had that discussion why, you know, we don't put an actual amount in there. So I didn't know we had a fund to be able to get it out of. So interesting.
Is that different than the disaster relief fund?
Right.
Yes,
it is.
Yeah. So through the chair, Representative Wilson, we'll get back to you on the exact amount. Since it wasn't an issue, I haven't studied up on it yet.
And Mr. Chair, if they've covered it, that's great. You don't need to put it in. We're just curious.
Are there further questions on the supplemental?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, and real quick, I mean, I want to follow up on that, but I'd love to see if we actually did return some money back in the general fund on the wildfires. Anyways, wasn't my question, but that was surprising. My question really actually is related to, obviously with the reduction in dividend, I know we do our make whole payments for welfare recipients in October because of the permanent fund. Was the permanent fund reduced to a point where we didn't have to I can't remember in the past. Well, I think it was like $36 million, and you can correct me, that we kind of, where we had pushed people because of the permanent fund over the line. And did we get to a point where some of that might have been reduced? I mean, I would expect to probably see it here in the supplemental as money put back in. Were we at that point, or do you know how close we got to that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I'll follow up on that. It has not come up as a major move this year, so we'll follow up. But it seems logical.
Yeah. Okay. No.
Additional questions?
Yeah. One.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Representative Wilson's question, I was told by a few people, I can't remember who, that we would see a supplemental for fire suppression expenses this year. And so I just want to, are we using up more of the fund than we normally would so that there isn't a supplemental? I mean, is the reason there's no supplemental that we're changing our policy for how much we'd like to have in the fund that funds fire suppression?
Through the chair, Representative Gare, we aren't changing the policy. We have not received a supplemental. We did not receive a supplemental request from DNR, and I'll follow up on the fund level and find out.
Are there any other questions that we want the director to follow up? Seeing none, thank you very much for the presentation. Our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, February 6th at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we'll have Legislative Finance Director David Teal presenting on a framework for analyzing fiscal plans, and we will adjourn early at 3:25.
DNR is managing the Medicaid.